and Yindriska, so.
Evil Emperor.
Evil Emperor.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
No, I'm the good. It's the good side of the Force. It's not the, I find your lack of faith disturbing. Who still needs the overall program? The overall program. Show your hands if you need it, if you lost it. No? Okay, then there's the handout one. Handout one, has everyone got that? Let me know if you haven't. And then handout... Whoa.
Okay, handout one.
Yeah, handout one, yeah. So, handout two, which is the one we're going to discuss today. Anyone need that? Okay. Okay, let's start. I heard that most of you snuck out yesterday. I will pick on you today and see whether you actually have seen 2001 recently and can talk about it intelligently. We shall see. But you can't get away with just sneaking out. I mean, you can watch the film elsewhere, but you have to watch these films. Okay, so the first session is just a discussion, but yesterday I had to rush to the second part of the lecture. I didn't miss that much, actually. I checked it. I did improvise reasonably well. But I did want to just make one thing very clear. What I said about 2001 as being a hugely influential film is directly demonstrated by the fact that George Lucas first thought up his follow-up to his disastrous first science fiction movie, THX-1138, 1971, disaster in terms of the troubles he had with the studio and the fact that it ruined the production company that he had set up together with Francis Coppola in San Francisco because it was a commercial flop and Warner Brothers withdrew funding from Zoetrope, which was later revived by Coppola. So it was a disaster, and after that film, which was a very abstract science fiction movie, he decided to make a much more user-friendly science fiction movie. And when he first talked about it in public, he described it something along the lines of 2001 meets James Bond. Yeah, so that was his... The reference point really is 2001 in that period. And although the film then took a different direction, as it were, the starting point really for making a big space adventure had to be 2001: A Space Odyssey. And similarly, when Steven Spielberg started to think about making his big space movie, he'd hired as many people from who had worked on 2001 as possible. Because that was the state of the art for science fiction special effects and for space adventures, or anything to do with extraterrestrials, evoking the otherness associated with them. So he hired as many people from 2001 as possible, and he showed the film to the crew during the production. So it's very clear that those two filmmakers who in 1977 basically redefined what popular cinema is with those two films were directly drawing on 2001. And if we look at James Cameron's biography, I'm reading from that biography about how James Cameron became a filmmaker. Yeah, we know that in 1962 he discovered that he was a little boy who might not live very long in the shadow of nuclear war, the threat of nuclear war. But here is how he became a filmmaker 6 years later, 1968, how he decided that no matter that the world might end any day, he was going to make movies. The first time he considered film as a career was in 1968, when at the age of 14, he staggered out of a Toronto movie theater showing 2001: A Space Odyssey. He reeled outside into the sunlight, sat down on the curb, and threw up from the vertigo of the third act psychedelic trip sequence. "I didn't know what to make of it," he says today. "It was really exciting intellectually, but mystifying and powerful visually. It was the moment Cameron went from being a fan of movies to wanting to make films himself." So I'm just trying to tell you that when I talk about these films, I'm not talking about just because I like them. I truly believe these are transformative films. And certainly for these filmmakers, they were transformative. And since I try to indicate to you that there is considerable evidence that these films, which were made in the wake of 2001 and then in the wake of Star Wars and Close Encounters, including all of Cameron's oeuvre culminating in Avatar, that these films, there's plenty of evidence that they have a potentially transformative impact on the audience in general. So I'm trying to give you the evidence. I'm not trying to tell you I like these films and I think they're important. I'm trying to tell you that there's plenty of empirical evidence that these films have real-world effects on other filmmakers and on audiences around the world. Okay, well, that was just to wrap up yesterday's lecture. Now, what are the questions? Compare and contrast 2001 and Avatar. What are the main similarities and differences? Don't start with the differences. Compare and contrast exercises are only interesting once you've established the similarities. So can we have some similarities between Avatar and 2001 A Space Odyssey? This is the discussion bit. This is where you talk. Anyone? Similarities between 2001 and Avatar? Okay, they're both science fiction movies. You start with the simple stuff. They're both set in the future. What else?
Basically, they're both humanity against someone or something.
Against? Would you say that 2001 is about being against something? Okay, it's about the relationship between humanity and some extraterrestrial civilization. In the case of 2001, this civilization is represented by the monoliths, and we never see the human, biological beings, if there are biological beings. You know, they might by now be, in the novel, they're actually spiritual beings. They have left their bodies behind, so they're just spiritual in the novel. But in the film, we don't know anything about the beings behind the machinery. So we just encounter their technology, and they seem to be basically benevolent. Yeah, they basically have enormous power, and they have an impact which allows humanity to develop. In Avatar, we have humanity encountering what seems to be a primitive civilization, but we also are exposed through Grace Augustine to the idea that Aiwa, the network of tree roots on the planet, forms an intelligence which is way more powerful than anything that human beings have ever encountered before. So Aiwa, although limited to this Noon Pandora, is potentially of a power comparable in some ways to the power of the aliens behind the monoliths. Yeah? So it's not necessarily a fight, but it is an encounter with an alien civilization which has tremendous power. And of course in Avatar, as we said yesterday, for so far, that power is ultimately used against humans. But what I suggested is that in the end, humans have to learn from that power. So in the end, by the end of the fourth film in the series, we will hopefully find that humanity can transform its own way of living, of being in the world, in accordance with what they might learn, not only from Jake, but also from Iva. So whatever transformation takes place will be ultimately brought about by Iva, in the same way that the transformation of pre-human hominids and the astronaut David Bowman into the Star Child is brought about by the monolith. Okay, what else? Anything else? Avatar and 2001. I mean, we did talk about the ending, the direct look at the camera, the challenge to the audience. We did talk about that already. And that seems to me fairly clearly a direct quote, almost. Although, as I said, in Avatar, it's more complicated because it's also Neytiri's point of view. It's not just the camera, it's Neytiri. So the character in the story doesn't just look at the camera, they look at the character in the story. And through that character at us. Anything else? Anything else at all? Well, let me just give you a few things. Most science fiction films completely ignore science. For example, that there is such a thing as gravity. Or lack of gravity. Yeah, they totally ignore this. So they always walk around on all their spaceship as if there was gravity, when unless they have developed some gravity generator, whatever that might be, there is no gravity. You know, unless the spaceship turns and creates artificial gravity, there is no gravity. But in 2001, of course, that's one of the most remarkable things, that people actually float around a lot, also in spaceships. And of course, that's the opening of Avatar, is when he wakes up, he then floats. Yeah, so it actually tries to be scientifically correct about simple things like gravity. What else can we say about the two films? Anything else? I'm trying to come up with more things. The way the spaceship is portrayed at the beginning in Avatar, I think it's very reminiscent. You know, that grand spaceship, when we see it for the first time outside, and then we see it in relation to a planet, the planet of which Pandora is a moon. That imagery seems to me very evocative, very reminiscent of the imagery of spaceships and planets or moons in 2001. So that seems to be very directly related. Anything else?
There is some sense of evil side of technology made by humans.
So yes.
With an Avatar, it's used as weapons, and the computer HAL returns against humans.
And there is the idea of the redemptive use of technology. Don't forget that Avatar goes out of its way to describe Iva as a kind of technology. Yeah, it's a neural network of tree roots. Normally, we use the term neural network in relation to, you know, artificial intelligence, computers built by humans to mimic the human mind. So it actually, and also, you know, they use terms like uploading and downloading. You know, Iva can upload and download information. In this particular case, the information that makes up a soul, yeah, a person. So the interesting thing is that while there's a lot of emphasis on the destructive side of technology, ultimately redemption comes through technology. But it's a wholly different kind of technology. The monoliths, we don't know what kind of technology it is. an Iowa is a kind of natural equivalent of a supercomputer. Yeah, it's not an actual technology, but it is described as if it was a technology. Also, of course, never be deluded into thinking that Avatar is anti-technology. Yeah, for example, what's the most effective technology that humans have ever had? Well, fire. You know, if you look at the whole history of human beings, fire is way more important than anything else. And then bow and arrow. Probably the vastly most important technology that humans have ever developed, bow and arrow. Yeah, so we must not think about technology as if it was has to be high-tech. Technology is any tool that helps us to manipulate the world. And for most of human history, fire and bow and arrows are way more important than anything else we can think of. So the film is not anti-technology. It first of all shows that there are different kinds of technologies used in different ways. So the assumption in Avatar is that the bow and arrow is used in a respectful way towards nature. Yeah, you kill those animals and you eat them, but you know, you pray over them and you thank them and everything, and you don't kill more than you actually need, and so on. And then what is more, that natural systems in Avatar are described as if they were technologies. So the whole difference between nature and technology, the film ultimately erases. So it's in no way anti-technology. It's a very good point. It's about the ambiguity of technology, because who uses it for what purposes? That's the question. Not whether we use technology or don't use technology. It's who uses it for what purposes. That's the central question in both films. And redemption ultimately comes for something which is close to a kind of, you know, supernatural, spiritual technology. That's where redemption comes from. Anything else? Anything else? Okay, what was your immediate sensual, emotional, intellectual response to 2001 this time and also on previous occasions when you saw the film, especially the first time you saw it? And how does your own response compare to that of the film's initial American audience about which you read in the piece I gave you to read? So who wants to say something about the first time they encountered 2001 and what they thought about it, or what they felt about it? Anyone? Or what you felt about it yesterday, or the last time you watched it? I mean, were you surprised about what you read about how American audiences responded to the film in 68, 69? Was that in line with your own experiences, or was it very unexpected? For example, who encountered the film thinking they would see a mainstream blockbuster? Okay. Who encountered the film in the context where they expected it not to be a mainstream blockbuster? Yeah? See, that's very different. That's a huge difference. In 1968, the marketing campaign promised the biggest epic ever. Yeah? A travelogue through space. You can't go with the Apollo mission to the moon, but you can go beyond the moon to Jupiter and the infinite with 2001. It was a mainstream blockbuster. Most people watching the film expected it to be a mainstream family entertainment blockbuster. And the amazing thing is, most of the people expecting this liked the film. And that's utterly amazing from today's point of view. We think it's an avant-garde experimental, you know, film. We think it's very difficult, and you know, you have to be very intelligent to make sense of it. That's not what people thought at the time. They thought they were going to get entertainment, and they were going to get, you know, family entertainment, and they felt they were getting something equivalent to it. See, that's very curious from today's point of view. I did not expect this. I did not expect that housewives, you know, 10-year-old children, you know, a fairly representative sample of Americans would write to Kubrick and be so enthusiastic about the film. And even when they felt troubled by the film, they actually felt that was a good way of being troubled. Yeah, it made them think. It made them view themselves and the world in a new way. They wanted to find out more about the film. So I think that's quite important. The mindset of the people in 1968-69, watching, approaching the film and watching it, is utterly surprising, I think, from today's point of view. But can we have some responses about how you encountered the film first, what your response was? Can we have some?
I saw it for the first time actually, and what was surprising for me was that how familiar it was, because I hadn't seen it before, but very many frames or bits of dialogue were very familiar because it has been referenced so much.
Yes, that's interesting. It's like when for the first time you read Hamlet or something, and you think, ah, oh, that's where that comes from. You know, it's almost every single phrase you think, oh, I know that one. Yeah, it has become a reference point in The Simpsons or, you know, anywhere in popular culture. A lot of these things pop up. And of course, the music is actually the other way around. It's like, you know, a lot of people have seen 2001 can never listen to the Strauss Waltz or Also Sprach Zarathustra again without thinking about the movie, so it works both ways. The film has penetrated popular culture, and so you come across it without even not necessarily knowing the film, but you still come across it. But in the same way, a lot of things in popular culture become completely overshadowed by the film. I mean, once you've seen the film, I think it's very different, very difficult to listen to Richard Strauss's, sorry, I'm mixing up my English and German pronunciation, Also Sprach Zarathustra. Yeah, it's very difficult to not think about 2001 once you've seen the film, when you hear that. So, yes, so it's penetrated popular culture, popular consciousness in very interesting ways. Anything else? Any other responses? Either this time or the first time you saw it, or any time in between? I mean, most people think it's a pessimistic film. You know, thousands of pages by academics have said this is a deeply pessimistic film. You know, humans are just, you know, male, phallus-obsessed murderers and meat-eaters. Technology will just produce murderous machines. Humans in the future will be dehumanized. They won't express any emotions. The most emotional character in the whole film is a computer, and so on. So academics are completely convinced that this is a deeply pessimistic film. And of course the response by Americans in 68-69 was the exact opposite. Yeah, this is the most gloriously optimistic, hopeful film ever produced. Yeah, for me that's, and I presume you, I mean, what was your response? Who thought the film, when they first saw it, was rather, I mean, if they had any opinion at all, was rather pessimistic? Yeah, a few. Who thought it was optimistic? Nah, not many. Most other people had not much of an opinion one way or the other. Maybe because these categories, you know, didn't even capture what the film was doing. Can we have any other responses? What I'm trying to get at here is that for me it was utterly surprising to find. You know, I told you in my written piece, I told you that I actually initially overlooked the fact that most people liked the film and found it optimistic because it's called confirmation bias. We perceive the world only in terms of what we already believe about the world. So if anything happens in the world that contradicts what we believe about it, we ignore it! Yeah? And that happens to scholars as well. Scholars look for evidence that confirms what they already think. Which is not real scholarship. Scholarship is actually about falsifying your beliefs and finding evidence for something you didn't know already. But I was completely convinced that, you know, it's a pessimistic film and, you know, people rejected it initially. So when I looked through all these letters, I only looked at the ones that rejected the film. And it took me months and months and months to realize that that's a small minority. Yeah, a small minority of the letters rejected the film. So for me, the most surprising thing is that people at the time, first of all, liked the film, and it wasn't just, you know, youth under the influence of drugs who liked the film. It was a cross-section of American society, first of all. And secondly, that they liked the film because they found it optimistic. Yeah, it took me a long time to actually realize that, because I didn't expect to see that, so I overlooked the glaring evidence. And now I presume
you saw the film in a completely different framework. You know, a lot of people, you know, six-year-old kids were just taken to the movies. You know, they had seen, you know, 2 years earlier they had seen The Sound of Music or Mary Poppins, and then, you know, because those were all road shows. So now they were taken to see, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey. It's all just a family affair, going to the movies, you know, and having a big spectacle. And, you know, they took it in that spirit. And I think today, most people see the film as, you know, it's art, not entertainment. It's difficult, not easy to enjoy. It might be, you know, pessimistic rather than optimistic, and so on. And there's a radical shift there. And part of my work about 2001 was to recover its original meanings for contemporary audiences in the United States, because I think that's what the filmmakers who then went on to make Close Encounters, Star Wars, and Avatar took away from the film. This tremendous sense of hope, this tremendous belief that things can be radically different. And I've been thinking a lot about how much this is grounded in the American society of the late 60s. You know, how much that is actually tied in, I said yesterday, to the space race and the hopes attached to that, but also general sense of cultural and social transformation in 60s America. And there is a lot of empirical evidence that continued into the late 60s and early 70s. A lot of people think 68 is the turning point. You know, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King get assassinated, and so on. So everyone gets depressed. Nixon gets elected. Everyone gets depressed, but it's not true. When you look at opinion polls, this enormous sense of optimism that Americans traditionally have anyway, and particularly in the 60s, continues into the early 70s. It's only around 72, 73 that there's a real shift in public opinion. And if public opinion reflects the public mood, then the shift really only comes in the 70s. So that's for me quite interesting, this tremendous sense of faith in the future, belief in a better future, confidence in a better future, and also that this willingness to consider that things could be radically different. And that's what the film taps into. And I think we've completely lost that for most of us. I mean, unless someone wants to contradict me and say, look, I saw it as a six-year-old, you know, and, you know, I became a science fiction fan for life afterwards, and I've always dreamed about going to space. You know, probably no one would say that, you know, I'm too embarrassed to admit it. But, you know, I think that's what the film plays on. This sense of there's no bounds to your dreams. Anything is possible. And even if you're a six-year-old, and I had lots of letters from six, eight, ten-year-old boys and girls, you know, writing, oh, you know, this is very exciting, you know, I am now interested in people on other planets and everything. I do believe. So, anyway, we have no more responses. No one wants to say anything. You guys really have to improve your note-taking on the questions, I have to say. Where are we now? Okay, let's move on to 2001 and Star Wars. Similarities and differences. Star Wars is the single most widely influential film. You know, 2001 had an impact on a fairly large audience in 1968-69, and it stayed in cinemas for years to come. It was, by 1972, one of the 25 highest grossing films in the United States, not adjusted for inflation. So that's pretty good. But of course, Star Wars broke all records. Yeah, so Star Wars is a whole different, you know. If 2001 inspired a lot of people, Star Wars really transformed, as far as cinema going is concerned, everything. You know, I would truly say that cinema going around the world was the single most important film that transformed what people expected to get out of cinema was Star Wars. But Star Wars wasn't possible without 2001. So, anything about comparison between 2001 and Star Wars? Similarities.
There seems to be a sort of kind of fetishization of the higher technology, like the robots and computers.
What do you mean by fetishization?
Picturing something rather deep and functional, probably more functional than it was at the time. These machines, maybe like computers, more developed.
Okay, so by fetishization usually is a negative term. let's try to say there's an emphasis on and a celebration of the beauty and the power of technology, but also, as we said, as the opposite, the danger of technology. Yeah, and of course, don't forget that, I don't know what your feelings about the Death Star are, but, you know, it's not just a celebration of the Death Star, you know what I mean? And, you know, both films put a lot of emphasis on machinery and the power of machinery and maybe the beauty of machinery, but also, of course, they put emphasis on the destructiveness of machinery. They also both feature computer stroke robots. You know, we have HAL, and then we have R2-D2 and C-3PO, very famously. So artificial machine intelligence in both films play an important role, but very differently. HAL is a slightly queer, you know, commandant for the ship, and C-3PO and R2-D2 are a slightly gay couple, stroke, you know, older brother, younger brother, whatever, you know, maternal older sibling and quirky younger sibling, whatever you see it, but definitely queer as well, I would say. I'm hopefully not shocking anyone here with revealing that C-3PO is not the most manliest of robots. But I think both films don't make that an issue, you know, they don't say this is terrible, you know, oh, they're not homophobic. But they play around with gender roles, that's for sure. What else? Star Wars and 2001. Come on.
Star Wars is more like fairy tale-ish. There's like a bad guy and a good guy, and they try to kill the bad guy. And there's no, like, that sense for technological accuracy. Like, there's a sound in the space.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the key differences is that one has fairy tale elements. It starts out a long time ago in the galaxy far, far away. And you're probably the most genius tagline of any film ever, you know. So that's great. A long time ago in the galaxy far, far away. That's galaxy far, far away is science fiction, but a long time ago, that's like once upon a time. It's fairy tale. And the question of scientific accuracy is addressed very differently in both films. You're absolutely right. But we're now already on to the differences. Let's talk a little bit more about similarities.
I don't think I could put it in similarities, but it's a very interesting thing. They're both science fiction movies.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting question is how it works with the speed of development. Because in the both movies, there are some about humanity thing. Like in 2001, it's the humans or beings behind the monolith.
Mm.
In Star Wars, is the Force. And the way how it impacts the civilization. Because in 2001, when monolith appears, completely changed everything. In the dawn of the human age, the ape is able. He finds how to use the tools.
Mm-hmm.
Then modern society starts looking to the space. In Star Wars, there should be a very long space history, like 1,000 years of the Empire, and the development is in contradict with the Force, almost none.
Okay.
There is a very, very fast development in the 2001, and very small impact of this above normal power in the world.
Okay. That's interesting. I would call both films epics. An epic is a film that tells a fairly localized story against the backdrop of important events in human, or, you know, beyond human history. So the biggest epic of all is 2001, because it starts. Well, there was a bigger one the year before called The Bible in the Beginning, which went to the first few books of the Bible. So it starts with, you know, God creating the world, and it ends with, I don't know where it ends. So there is probably an even bigger epic, but it's probably the biggest epic ever, apart from anything to do with the Bible. So it starts with the transition from pre-humans to humans, and it ends with, in 2001, with the possibility that humans might be raised to a higher level of existence. So that's pretty epic. Star Wars also is epic, but it's a political epic. Yeah, that a lot of people don't see that. No, the scrolling text at the beginning, it was a time of civil war, bloody, bloody, blah. You know, there's an evil emperor, and there's a, you know, and there's rebel forces, and there's this new technology. And you think, who the hell would want to watch a film like that? You know, the text at the beginning tells you it's a time of civil war. That's actually how the epics of the 50s and 60s operated. You know, the biblical epics. It was at the time of the Roman Empire, or something like that. You know, it always starts with a voiceover telling you about, oh, momentous things are happening. You know, there's this empire, and there's this young, you know, carpenter from Judea, and, you know, he's going to change everything. So, but Star Wars is a political epic. A lot of people forget that. Technology, yes, but it's political. There's a democracy which gives rise. There's a democratic republic which has a Senate, but the Senate is gradually taken over by someone who will rule the empire, the republic, which turns into an empire, in an autocratic fashion. And the most famous examples in history are Caesar, you know, taking over the Roman Empire, and Hitler taking over the Weimar Republic. That's the models. That's what it is. It's a political epic. Surprisingly, technology as such plays very little role in it. I mean, it's the MacGuffin that Hitchcock would say. You know, there's the Death Star, it can destroy a whole planet in one go. And once that's built, you know, no one can resist the evil emperor. But in actual fact, and I think you're getting at something there, the question is, what is the relationship between the Force and that political shift? Yeah? And of course, in the first one, we don't quite know, because both the good guys and the bad guys are basically old-fashioned believers in the Force. And that's something very confusing about the first Star Wars, that both Luke Skywalker, not Luke Skywalker, Obi-Wan is an old man, completely out of step with his times, living in the desert somewhere, but he believes in this ancient religion about the Force. And they say the same thing about Darth Vader. Yeah? When they all sit around, all the generals, you know, and they make fun of the Force, then he says, I find your lack of faith disturbing. And he does the, you know, not the Jedi mind trick, but the kind of evil, you know, the evil mind trick. And we know that, you know, people like Darth Vader have gone over to the dark side of the Force. Yeah? So we have two things going on in Star Wars. On the one hand, we have a political epic, which is based on the Roman Empire's transition to become an empire rather than a republic through Caesar. And then it's the Weimar Republic giving way to the Third Reich. That's, by the way, spelled out very, very explicitly in the prequel trilogy. The prequel trilogy, you know, there are machinations through which Senator Palpatine is elected, you know, to rule the Senate in a temporarily autocratic fashion. That's how Caesar got into power, into real power, and that's how Hitler got into power, you know, to have special powers given to him by the parliament, by the Senate. But at the same time, it's about an old-time religion coming back and determining things. Yeah? It's not technology. It's the fact that Darth Vader, and we then find out the evil emperor, have access to the dark side of the Force. And the only thing that can resist that are the people who are willing to commit themselves to the good side of the Force, the light side of the Force. Yeah, so that, I think, is the story of Star Wars, a political epic in the context of the recovery of an old-time forgotten religion or spiritual practice that actually determines everything that happens. And I think the connection with 2001 would be that the monoliths, for all intents and purposes, stand in for a divine power, which, you know, orchestrates all events. But Star Wars is different insofar as this divine power has no intent on its own. We have to assume that the monoliths, the intelligence behind them, has an intention. which is to foster intelligence in the universe, intelligent life in the universe, we have to assume that intelligence has its own intentions. But in Star Wars is more interesting in that respect, because the Force has no intentions. Because the Force is just there, it embraces us all. Yeah? And when you get access, when you open yourself to the Force, you then have to make a decision. Do you use it for selfish purposes and go over to the dark side, or do you use it for non-selfish purposes and use it for altruistic purposes? Yeah? But I think you're right that in Star Wars it's a bit more tricky to actually see that there's a lot going on in the first film, because it's a political transition from a democracy to a dictatorship, but it's tied to this recovery of an old-time religion. Okay, what else? Anything else? I actually think I know probably you all have seen Star Wars many, many times, but I actually think it's very difficult to appreciate how unusual the film is. It's very difficult to appreciate that the hero doesn't make an appearance until a quarter of an hour into the film. Instead, you have these bumbling idiots, you know, these two robots. You think, what the hell is this? And Lucas, you know, because Lucas wanted to make a film for teenagers. And then the more he did research, the more he realized he was going to make a children's film. And it terrified him. Because in the 70s, films defined as children's films were not making money before Star Wars. Yeah, between 67 and 76, children's films did not really make much money in their first release. So Lucas said, oh my God, I've spent $10 million on a children's film. And children's film, at most, you know, if they're lucky, they earn $10 million. You know what I mean? And I've already spent $10 million. It's crazy. And then people said, look, throw out these robots at the beginning. This is crap. You know, it will totally alienate every serious viewer to have these idiots bumbling around for no particular purpose, as far as I can see. You know, do away with this. You know, all this fairy tale nonsense. And the only one who said, no, George is going to make $100 million. Who was that? Steven Spielberg. Even seeing the film with all the battle, space battle sequences cut together from World War II, air fighting footage, even with that, you know, with a lot of the special effects missing, the music being all out of whack, Steven Spielberg said, everyone else hated it and said, George, this is the end of your career, this is it, you know, you've had it. And only Steven Spielberg said, this is going to make $100 million, you know. Only Steven Spielberg saw that this was utter genius. And I think it's very difficult for us to see how strange that film is today. And I've tried to write about that a lot. You know, that there was no precedent. All the generic traditions the film draws on were not successful in the decade from 67 to 76. It was completely out of step with its times. It does crazy things with a scroll at the beginning and giving you political information. I mean, when have you last seen a movie which starts with giving you a blurb about, you know, the politics? You know what I mean? We don't associate that with mainstream movie going. So I think it's very difficult to appreciate how radical this film is. You know, so it's very difficult to appreciate how much 2001 was perceived and experienced as mainstream entertainment. And it's very difficult to see how utterly strange Star Wars was when it came out. But of course, once you overcome the initial strangeness, suddenly this great familiarity sets in. You know, it's fairy tales, it's myth, you know, it's epic, it reminds you of all kinds of childhood experiences and so on. But there's this initial shock of strangeness, which I think it's very difficult for us today to understand how strange that film was. So I like to actually look at certain scenes quite closely. Also, of course, the resolution at the end has, I already mentioned that, is not technological. Trust the Force, Luke. You know, that's the, or may the fourth be with you. You know, that's the national Star Wars Day, isn't it? May the fourth be with you. Anyway, terrible joke. Not mine, I got it from someone else. Okay.
Let's see, what else? So Star Wars is more explicitly spiritual even than 2001. In 2001, you could say it's just a superior intelligence. For all intents and purposes, that superior intelligence is divine, because their power seems to be fairly unlimited, the people who the things that constructed the monoliths. But Star Wars really is an explicitly spiritual film. There's no way to watch Star Wars and just see it in a secular framework. I think it's totally impossible. If you don't believe, if you completely refuse to believe in any sense of higher powers, or, you know, things that bind the whole universe together, a kind of, you know, not an intelligence, but a spiritual force that penetrates all material and biological things. You know, if you don't believe in that, it's very difficult to actually engage with a film. It makes no sense whatsoever. You know, you would be like Harrison Ford, who says, yeah, I don't believe in this old mumbo jumbo, you know, I'm a realist, you know. And of course he's wrong. That's the whole thing about the film. He's wrong. And if you would refuse to engage with all of this, you couldn't enjoy the film. And of course a lot of people have taken it to the other extreme. I think in Australia you can now, they have now allowed it, and I don't know whether they've done it in Britain and other countries, when in the census people are asked for their religion, they are now allow the entry Jedi, which I think is completely crazy, because I'm not sure what that means, but, you know, Jedi mind trick, you know, these are not the droids you're looking for. So 2001 was easily understandable as a spiritual and religious film, but it was equally easily understandable as a purely scientific film, a totally secular film. With Star Wars, it's utterly impossible, I think. When you engage with a story, you have to accept, for the purposes of engaging with a story, that there are spiritual forces at work in the universe, and that those are the most powerful forces. Technology is nothing. Human agency is only something in relation to the fourth force. Technology is nothing. And that's what the ending says. You know, trust the force. Don't trust technology. So the two films are similar but also very different. And of course, interesting, Close Encounters is, again, it could be understood as purely scientific, but it's very hard to do that. After all, it's about a guy who has visions and he goes up the mountain and he encounters, you know, heavenly beings. And in order to run the point home, what movie do they watch in Close Encounters at home? In the background, it's running. The kids don't want to see it. The Ten Commandments, which is about Moses, who went up a mountain to encounter God. You know what I mean? So Close Encounters is in between Star Wars and 2001, because it's a film which could be understood as purely scientific, but it's so heavily invested in the spiritual dimension. Yeah, a visionary who has visions of, you know, this mountain, he has to climb up that mountain, and then of course once he's there, in this particular case, he doesn't bring down the stone tablets, he ascends to heaven at the end. Yeah, it's very difficult not to say that's a religious film. E.T., by the way, is similar. Initially you could say, well, it's just aliens, you know, on an expedition to find plant life and examine it, and then they leave one behind and everything. But Spielberg worked with it on E.T., which incidentally was the film that beat Star Wars in terms of ticket sales during its initial release. And E.T. is still the film that sold more tickets in America during its initial release than any other film ever, before or since, by a long margin. So E.T. is basically a story about a heavenly being coming to Earth, first encountered properly in a shed. The woman associated with this heavenly being is a woman called Mary. He then walks around healing people
by putting the hands on them, he dies, is resurrected, and goes up to heaven at the end. So when Spielberg was working on the script with Melissa Matheson, at some point he said, if my Orthodox Jewish grandmother knew I was doing a Jesus movie, she would really turn in her grave. Yeah, so Close Encounters is a very Jewish movie, as it were, because Moses is Old Testament. And strangely enough, E.T. is a very Christian movie, which Spielberg really found very disturbing, being Jewish and all. Okay, so what I'm trying to get at is there are very intense connections between these big science fiction films from 77 onwards in 2001, but some of those connections are predictable. They have to do with special effects, with space adventure, with alien beings and so on. But some of them are less so obvious. And that's what I want to emphasize. This emphasis on the spiritual or the religious is very much present in these films from 77 onwards. And it's already there in 2001. You don't have to see it in 2001, but it's there. You can see it. And it's made very explicit in the big science fiction blockbusters. Not all of them, but many of them. Certainly, Star Wars, Close Encounters, E.T., and Avatar. Okay. Yep. We're not behind time yet. I'm surprised. How do 2001 and Star Wars fit into trends at the U.S. box office since the 30s? What patterns can you discuss, can you discern amongst the biggest hits, and how do they change over time? Now, I've helped you with this by breaking it down into the main periods. Yeah, so I figured out that there are certain breaks in American film history, and I helped you with this. So how would you say Star Wars and 2001 fit into trends? Or what patterns do you discern from one period, the roadshow era? Well, actually, the first one is the tour. Well, before 1949, I guess we could call it the studio era, or the classical era. And then we have the roadshow era, the new Hollywood, and the new Hollywood. Anyone want to comment on that? How do the films fit in or not fit in? And what other patterns do you discern in the shift from one period to the next? Can we have some opinions here? You have been working all night making notes on this. Surely you can tell me something about your results. Okay, the first thing. How about science fiction before 77? Silch. Yeah, and if you would look at the annual top 10, there would still be very, very little. How about science fiction from Star Wars onwards? Yeah, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, E.T., Return of the Jedi, Jurassic Park, Independence Day, Star Wars again, Spider-Man, Avatar, Avengers Assemble. So I think it's borne out that science fiction becomes the dominant genre, especially if you link it to fantasy, whereby the link with fantasy is not only about world building, alternative universes that we can imagine, but it's often also about spiritual powers. Yeah, the ring that unites them all. Yeah, that's very similar to the Force and the dark side of the Force and so on. Or in Harry Potter, you know, magic, wizardry. Yeah, so the most dominant films from 77 onwards are science fiction films and fantasy films, whereby in both genres, explicit or implicit, spiritual and religious things play an important role. Is that true for earlier periods in other genres? Does religion and spirituality play a role in earlier periods? The answer is yes. Why? 1949 to 66. The robe, basically about Jesus. Ten Commandments, Moses. Ben-Hur, Jesus. That's it. But at least, you know, the several of the top films from that period, and if you go further down in the charts, there's many, many more.
basically biblical epics were one of the key genres of the period 49 to 66 in terms of success. Yeah, in 66 the second highest grossing film was The Bible in the Beginning. Yeah, then they go out of fashion from 67 to 76. The only religious films, explicitly religious films in the charts, tend to be demonic possession, devilish films. Most famously, The Exorcist. From 77, religion comes back, but in the guise of science fiction and fantasy. The only exception being The Passion of Christ, The Passion of the Christ, which is an explicitly Christian biblical film. Yeah, so do you see the pattern? 49 to 66, biblical films, biblical epics, 77 onwards, fantasy and science fiction epics with a spiritual or religious slant to them, either explicit or implicit. Anything else that you observe? The presence of Disney films is a problem, Disney animation, because they're being re-released every few years. So they accumulate their earnings, not during their initial release, but over many decades. So that's why you have some Disney animated films for the early decades, because they're just being endlessly re-released. So in a sense, we almost have to discount the early Disney films. Do you see any other patterns? Okay, let me ask you. Which films are based on best-selling material? You know, a particular source in another medium which was already a bestseller before the film came along. Is there a pattern? Gone with the Wind, one of the biggest selling books in American history. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, extremely famous fairy tale. Pinocchio, famous fairy tale. Fantasia, original story. Bambi, the famous children's book. The Robe, extremely best-selling novel. Around the World in 20 Days, classic Jules Verne novel. The Ten Commandments, the Bible. Ben-Hur, very best-selling novel. Sleeping Beauty, fairy tale. 101 Dalmatians, famous children's book. Cleopatra, not based on any particular source. So that's an original script, as it were. Mary Poppins, famous children's book. Goldfinger, best-selling novel. Sound of Music, one of the biggest Broadway musicals of all time. Dr. Zhivago, Nobel Prize-winning best-selling novel. Thunderball, James Bond novel adaptation. Jungle Book, famous children's book. The Graduate, obscure novel. So that's one of the rare exceptions to the rule that the biggest films tend to be based on the biggest hits in other media. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, original script based on an historical case. Love Story, one of the best-selling novels of all time. Airport, one of the best-selling novels of all time. The Godfather, the best-selling American novel of the 1970s. The Exorcist, the second best-selling novel of the 70s. The Sting, original script. American Graffiti, original script. Blazing Saddles, original script. Very original script, I should say. Jaws, one of the best-selling novels of all time. Do you see a pattern here? Before 67, it virtually never happens that a breakaway hit is based on an original script. They're always based on a Broadway musical, a best-selling novel, or a classic novel. From 67 to 76, we have a mixture. It's still dominated by bestseller adaptations. What happens from 77 onwards? Star Wars, original script. Grease, best-selling Broadway show. Empire Strikes Back, original script, but sequel. Raiders of the Lost Ark, original script. E.T., original script. Return of the Jedi, original script, but sequel. Beverly Hills Cop, original script. Ghostbusters, original script. Do you see a pattern here? Suddenly, original scripts. These films are not dependent anymore of having already been successful, the stories having already been, or the music, having been successful in another medium. Suddenly, we have original scripts. But then, of course, we also have sequels. Batman, a classic comic strip. Home Alone, original script. Jurassic Park, best-selling novel. The Lion King, original script. Incidentally, the first classic animated Disney film based on an original script, not a classic fairy tale or children's book. Forrest Gump, obscure novel. Independence Day, original script. Titanic, original script. Star Wars Episode I, original script. Spider-Man, classic comic book, Shrek 2, original script, Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, loosely based on, you know, Disneyland, right? But not really. So basically, original script, Dark Knight, comic strip, Avatar, original script, Avengers Assemble comic strip. But do you see a shift? Before 77, Hollywood's biggest hits in the United States are virtually never original scripts. They're virtually always based on something else. Since 77, since Star Wars, since you know, George sat down and wrote the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, which eventually he condensed into Star Wars, since and Spielberg did the same, sitting down, writing Close Encounters, since that time, original scripts dominate at the box office. Now, in recent years, that seems to shift, because, you know, we have the Avengers franchise dominating so much, and we have the Hunger Games franchise, and we have the Transformers franchise, which is loosely based on a toy and a television series. But, you know, you see, there's a shift there. There's a real significant shift around 77. For the first time in American film history, it seems, the breakaway hits are based on original scripts. Original in the sense of not based specifically on one source which is already successful in another medium. Do you notice anything else? Okay, where are these films set? Gone with the Wind, okay, United States. Okay, let's ignore Before 49, but as I said, the animated films are a bit of an exception there. 49, The Robe, set in the Middle East. Around the World in 80 Days is set around the world. The Ten Commandments, Middle East. Ben-Hur, Middle East. Sleeping Beauty, Europe. Medieval Europe. The 101 Dalmatians, Britain, I think. Cleopatra, Egypt. Mary Poppins, Britain. Goldfinger, Britain and the States. The Sound of Music, Austria. Dr. Zhivago, Russia, Soviet Union. Thunderball, Britain and around the world. Yeah, it's all outside the United States. So what I said about Hollywood being very successful since 77 outside the United States, with films which are set outside the United States, feature non-American characters, and are often shot outside the United States, to a large extent that applies to the period 49 to 66. Yeah, so that Europeanization or globalization of Hollywood takes place not in the late 70s or 80s, it happens in the 50s. Yeah, and a lot of these films, The Robe has, I'm not sure whether it has a single American star in it. Around the World in 80 Days, mostly British. Ten Commandments, of course, there's always Charlton Heston, but apart from that, Ben-Hur, Charlton Heston. But in most of these films, the actors are not Americans, or the vast majority. So they're not only set outside the United States, they also have foreign characters. And they have foreign settings, and quite a few of those films were also partly shot in Europe because it was much cheaper. And that changes from 67 to 76. Okay, The Jungle Book is an exception. The Graduate is set in the United States, contemporary United States. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 19th century United States. Love Story, contemporary United States. Airport, contemporary United States. The Godfather, recent past United States. The Exorcist, United States contemporary. The Sting, 30s America. Blazing Saddles, 19th century America. Jaws, contemporary America. Yeah, that's a radical shift. From 49 to 66, Hollywood basically made, when it made its most successful films in the United States, it made basically hugely Europeanized films. Even in America, the biggest hits were Europeanized films. Set outside the United States, well, Europeanized and Middle Easternized. It's set outside the United States, featuring foreign actors, often shot outside the United States. From 67 to 76, radical shift. Very inward-looking. And also the historical span becomes very narrow. Before 67, the span goes, if you include a film like The Bible in the Beginning, from the beginning of the world, you know, until the 20th century, from 67 to 76, the span for most of the big hits is basically from about the 1870s to the 1970s.
and the vast majority of them are set in the 70s. Yeah? Do you see that? That's a radical shift. Now, what happens from 77 onwards? Star Wars? Well, first of all, that's tricky. It's set in the past, isn't it? And it's not set in America, that's for sure. So it's set outside the United States and outside the present. Greece is 50s America. Empire Strikes Back is like Star Wars. Raiders of the Lost Ark is 30s Europe and America. It is contemporary US. Return of the Jedi, alternative universe. Beverly Hills Cop, contemporary America. So what you see here is a combination of what happens in the new Hollywood and the roadshow era. Except that the roadshow era's emphasis on non-American settings now moves into space or into fantasy worlds. But at the same time, you have a series of hits which are as focused on contemporary America and American actors and characters as the films from 67 to 76. Now, I don't want you to remember all this, but I want you to see that there are clear patterns. Now, you can then, of course, try to explain these patterns, which takes a long time, and I've written a little book about it, but only one of the changes. Try to explain the change from the roadshow era to the new Hollywood. So I've written a book about that, which is called The New Hollywood. But there are clear shifts here amongst the breakaway hits. Not amongst Hollywood's overall output, but amongst the films that Hollywood is most successful with in the United States, there are clear shifts. And these shifts work, as I said, a lot of what's happening since 77 is many traditions of the roadshow era are combined with certain aspects of the new Hollywood. And that leads into the major hit patterns since 77. And the dominant one is science fiction and fantasy films addressed to a family audience. That's probably the last point I want to make. Before 67, all the biggest hits with a question mark around the Bond films are basically films for the whole family. That's what the production code was for. And a lot of them are very explicitly based on fairy tales, children's books, and so on. From 67 to 76, we have a lot of taboo material, a lot of sex and violence, including in Jaws. These are films which you wouldn't necessarily... And The Exorcist, you know, in the States you can take your six-year-old niece to The Exorcist. An R rating only means everyone under 18 has to be accompanied by a child. But you wouldn't want to do that necessarily. Yeah? From 77 onwards, with few exceptions, the biggest hits are once again family-oriented. And that's very clear when you read the marketing materials and the original reception of Star Wars. It was very much perceived as a kind of Disney film, as indeed was Close Encounters, and most notably E.T. And even Raiders was partly discussed in terms of the Disney tradition of all-encompassing family entertainment. Okay, so the period 67 to 76 stands out in many, many different ways. Okay. I talked again. You were supposed to talk. Okay. This is an absurdly long manuscript, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Shall we open the window for a moment? Just a 2-minute break for, you know, toilet and such. I can't do it. The new Hollywood. I mean, certain traditions of the roadshow era are combined with or mixed in with the ones of the new Hollywood.